So we can see, as we know, that there is a general expectation on the Christian church to offer, practice, exercise, do hospitality without grumbling. I like that, without grumbling, but it should be one of the marks of being a Christian. And it should be one of the marks of a Christian community, along with kindness, love, service, etc., etc. But, you know, maybe it doesn't really apply to us in London. Maybe it only works when you have much more functional contexts. I've been to Uganda on several occasions. I lived there for a year, and then I've been back a few times. And I would say that there is a general expectation of kindness and hospitality that is really felt by all and exercised by all. And it's very rude if you have a stranger come into your community and not to offer that hospitality. It's almost unthinkable. But, you know, civilization started in Africa, so they're definitely way ahead of us in terms of how you function as a society and how as a community. It's also a more rural context, and we live in a sprawling metropolis where we try and spend a lot of our time forgetting that we live close by 9 million other people. You know, when you go away from London and you have a nice time, and, you know, in fact, when I've been to Uganda and I've come back, and you start saying hello to people randomly on the street, and they just look at you as if you're a lunatic, you know, and you smile at people, you make eye contact on the tube. Who does that? No one does that. On the tube, we try and pretend that there is no one else there, especially when they're right by our face, right? So we live all squished in together, and we find it hard to know. We are so close to so many people, and yet we have so little connection with so many of them. So how do we work this out in 21st century London when we're so time poor and always on the go? I think the truth is, although it's always hard to work these things out, it is absolutely vital, particularly in our context, in 21st century London when we're always on the go. I think one of my earliest examples of hospitality, speaking personally, was when I was a teenager, and I grew up in a place called Ashton in Surrey, which is a very nice place to live. And basically, we had a youth group, and our youth leaders used to have us round to their house every single week. Now, at the time, it didn't really seem, that's to me, you know what teenagers are like. They don't really think that there was probably an implication to these people who looked after us. And their names were Mike and Mary King and Jeff and Sarah Boswell. And they basically, from the age of, say, 13 to 18, they had an open door policy once a week, and we all piled into their house. And I think it was smelly. I'm absolutely certain no one ever took any food ever along, not one time, because we just felt like this is where we hang out. You know, and when you start thinking about it, you realise that that must have been quite a thing. Because not only did they have us those days, they then probably, I know they did, spent time with the kids, you know, because there's always stuff going on with a bunch of teenagers. So they would then spend time out of that with them individually. And it's an incredible gift. It was an incredible gift to give to us, and I'm not sure we entirely appreciated it, but I do now, and I met them, a couple of them the other, about a year ago, and I just want to thank you, because at the time, I probably said, oh, thanks, but I didn't appreciate just what you did as an extraordinary thing. Now, of course, this happened in Surrey, which my children tell me that because I grew up in Surrey, I know next to nothing about life. Apparently, Surrey, in all its ruralness, it's not very rural, it's one of the home counties, very nice place, is totally different and gives me an almost zero understanding of what it is actually like in the real world too, and therefore, you know, what I can expect of them is almost entirely different and cannot in any way be based on my own experience. However, in this instance, they have a slight point in that where we live, they own their own houses. The houses were large enough to host that number of teenagers, however sort of squished. Does it really work in London when, you know, it's very rare for people to have houses big enough to squish in lots and lots of teenagers? When we often live in flats, when we might share flats, we might be sharing with people who absolutely no way are going to let a large number of people in. So how does it work in our context? And I think probably the most important thing about hospitality, as is often the case with God, is that the heart of the matter is the matter of the heart, if you like. So hospitality is more about a state of mind. It's more about an openness towards people, seeking to bless people where we are with what we have, rather than being able to sort of host lots and lots of people all the time. Seeking to bless those we come into contact with. It starts with our heart. It starts with us knowing that we have had so much more from God than we can ever contain. And therefore, as a result of that, we want to reach out to people and we want to bless them. We want to do life with them because we know that love has been lavished on us. And when we just lavish a little bit on other people, we are just giving from a tiny bit of the extraordinary sort of well that is within us that's been poured over us. So biblical hospitality is probably more about sharing our lives with people, I would say, than being a great host or hostess. More about doing life together than being a domestic goddess. But if we do share our lives, there is definitely some context in which we will invite them in to our houses or to be close to us. As we know, can we have the next slide? An Englishman's home is his castle. What does that mean? It means we like to think that we can withdraw from the world, that we can sit behind moats, behind high walls with little slits, where we can shoot arrows at people. We can pour burning oil on people if we don't like them very much. And we can feel safe and the world doesn't have to touch us. Thank you very much. But if we're called to share our lives with people, then we will have to, you know, we can't be a castle. Or if we're a castle, we'll have to let down the drawbridge. We'll have to stop, you know, being threatening and defensive. And we'll have to start being much more open. Castles are designed to keep people away and to keep the people inside safe. Can we have the next slide? Castles worked from about 9th century, around the time of Charlemagne, to 15th century, by which time we'd invented gunpowder and the defensive strategies of castles weren't as relevant. You see, that little piece of information you wouldn't have known if you hadn't come this morning. Thank you. It's okay. Here are some defensive features. High moat, high walls, which are hard to climb. Metal portcullis gate at the door, deep moats, so you had to use a drawbridge, you couldn't just walk in, round towers with battlements, for soldiers to keep watch from, and arrow slits to fire arrows through. So castles worked very well until they invented gunpowder. They kept lots of nasty people out, and they kept the people inside safe, which is why they were built kind of all over the place. But it doesn't work as human beings. We're not actually castles. We're not designed to function like castles. And if we try and function like a castle, life does not go well for us. If we try and function like a castle, can we have the next slide? We end up a little bit like Calvin. I don't know if you can read what he's saying. Let me try. Okay, so he's talking about, he's this snow fort, and he builds this impenetrable wall, and it's amazing, and it's high, and no one is going to be able to touch him. And so he waits on his own in this impenetrable, safe snow castle. And then he waits a bit more, and then he decides that it is not fun at all to be on your own behind an impenetrable wall. And so he comes out, and he says, "I'm outside my fort now." So he spends a lot of time making himself safe, and then he realizes that the very thing that has created safety has stopped him from actually enjoying what he wants to enjoy, and so he has to leave it. And I would say that's a little bit like us. And that's partly why Claire Gates and Kate Logan and I set up the center, which people here will know about. Because we felt like there is a crying need in our society to have healthy relationships, to know what it means to connect with people. And as a consequence of sort of what we've been doing, I've done lots of reading about brains and how we function and how human beings work best and how we work best with babies, etc., etc., etc. And the very exciting thing, I would say, is that this is a huge area of science which is developing and changing and shifting all the time, which is essentially proving time and time and time again that when God said it's not good for us to be on our own, he absolutely knew what he was talking about. And the science, instead of now questioning our faith in God, is proving it point after point after point after point. And this is all done against a backdrop, really, where we're living increasingly on our own. In 1950, 4 million Americans lived on their own. In 2001, it had risen to 30 million. Which puts incredible strain on the relationships that we have. And I would say that even living in nuclear families puts quite a lot of strain on those families, because, again, we probably were designed to have quite a lot more close relationships. It's probably better for us if we live in sort of more extended communities, where if our children are driving us completely nuts, someone else will step in and speak nicely to them. Or where we don't need to get all our emotional needs for support and love and affection from one person, because that puts incredible strain on that one relationship. And social sort of scientists and psychologists would say that is one of the factors that leads to quite a lot of family breakdown. It's because it is so loaded and we just don't have enough strong relationships. So I'm looking to this one person who is flawed and messed up as me, and they're not going to meet all our needs, and so we don't know what to do. But they weren't ever really designed to meet all our needs. So we know now, we've got significant advances in how we know how the brain works. We can take pictures of the brain with MRI scans, and we can even video what's going on in our brains with fMRI scans. So we suddenly have this whole world of information that's opened up to us. Sue Johnson, who writes a lot about this, she's a marriage therapist, she said this: "The first and foremost instinct of humans is neither sex nor aggression. It is to seek contact and comforting connection." So emotional dependency for us is not immature or pathological, it's our greatest strength, and it is our greatest need. You know, we know, don't we? We all saw pictures sort of 30 years ago of Romanian orphans who were brought up with enough food to survive but didn't have human contact, and it had an incredibly detrimental effect on them because they didn't have what they actually needed. We also know that the worst thing you can do to prisoners is put them in solitary confinement. And within a very, very short space of time, it is very hard for them to keep a grip on what is going on in their world. Lisa Gunther, who's looked into how we deal with prisoners, says this: "When we isolate a prisoner in solitary confinement, we deprive him of the support of others, which is crucial for her coherent experience of the world." They did an experiment with monkeys called Harlow's monkeys. You can look it up online. And they had a group of these little monkeys, and they had a cloth mother who had kind of a comforting presence but didn't dispense food. Then they had a wire mother who did dispense food, and they looked at who the monkeys would most readily go to. And you'd think that food would come first, but actually they would first off go to the cloth mother because she was a comfort for them. And the person who was involved in the experiment said, "Food is sustenance, but a good hug is life itself." So we know as human beings, we are called to actually live in community, in relationship with each other. We function best. That's actually how we're designed. And I think that's the amazing thing. The more we look into these brains of ours, the more we look into hormone levels, the more we look into all the different brain functioning, we see that everything functions best when we have close connection, when we feel loved, and when we feel accepted. And also, I would say, in a Christian community, so we're all human beings, right? So we need that. But even more so, if you think of how Paul describes the Christian community, it's like a body. It's like we're all part of the same body. So it's not just that you need each other as human beings to feel okay. A church is supposed to function so closely that we can actually call it one body. So you might look around and think, you know, how does that work? How does that work? How do we do that? How do we work so intimately closely with each other that we could be described as one body? We have a huge need to connect. We have a huge sort of imperative, this is where my brain's gone, to live closely, to work closely in church together. Now, I don't know, can we just do the next one? Yeah, great. You won't be able to read all of this. But I think I'm not really going to go into the whole social media thing, but I think one of the things that can give us a full sense of connection is something like Facebook. So here is a post I posted, I think, on the 5th of May, 2000 this year. And fortunately, you can't see all the comments. John's got a rather strange look on his face. And so a lot of the comments were, you know, joking, ha, ha, ha. But, you know, in general, it's quite a happy picture. We're at the seaside. It's quite a nice time. I chose to post that picture. What I didn't show was the night before we went and had a really nice time, we were all getting on at the seaside, is that we had an argument that had we actually shown it would have looked more like this. Okay. So we had a full-blown, everyone almost yelling at each other, lots of people crying, well, mostly me, argument. Do I put that on Facebook? Absolutely not. If you live closely with me, if you live next door, might you have picked that up? Absolutely. But if your connection with me is via Facebook, I can put up whatever I like, which is why people have life envy of other people on Facebook, because I don't know about you, but most people who I follow or I'm friends with on Facebook, they don't put the rubbish things. They put the sweet things their children say. They put the nice times they have together. They put the holidays. They put the whatever. Whatever else we're feeling underneath, we can present this image. You know, and it's very appealing. But if you have a conversation with me and I'm not in a good place, you will pick it up. If you just see a photo of me, I'm a little bit safe. It's a little bit like having a nice moat around me. So I would say instead of connecting people, it probably sort of actually can be rather unhelpful. We probably need to put the row face off now. What's the next one? Is there another one? Oh, yeah. Okay, we'll leave that. I'll just explain that in a minute. Okay, good. Now, some people, of course, find offering hospitality and find sharing lives with people a lot easier than others. I've always felt, I really like people, and I've always felt that I could have actually functioned quite well in a kibbutz, and here's a happy picture of kibbutznik dancing. And I've always thought, I could probably live in community. I probably could. Quite like people, quite like them all the time. I probably couldn't. I'd probably go completely and utterly nuts. And I'm certainly married to someone who would probably go nuts within about 7.5 minutes, I would say. And so there's some of us who go, yes, sharing lives together, absolutely great, can't wait, let's just do more of it. And you say, let's have a church weekend, and they go, let's not just have a weekend, let's have a week. And then you say, have a church week, and they go, how about we just meet every other, you know, every weekend? How about we do this? And it's kind of like, really? You know, and then there's others of us who think, are you actually joking? Basically, if I accidentally turn up at church too early, so that I have to talk to people over coffee, that is enough. I do not need to contact with anyone else at any time. I will come in, I will read my paper, and don't disturb me. So we come with lots of different gifts, don't we? And I would say, you can see people in our church community who have a gift of hospitality. Henrietta and Rick would be a good example. There are always people who invite people in. Who are people who have a sort of gift of healing? Well, they're the people up the front praying for people. Who are the people who have a particular gift of hospitality? They're the ones offering invitations. You know, Matt and Sadie Windsor Richards, you know, another very good example. They're the people in Jack's house who you might not know, but, you know, they're always the people who are always inviting people in, who are saying, let's do life together. And those people have a gift. And just as they have a, you know, we're not called to all do that, but we are called to get a little bit better, a little bit stronger, practice it a little bit more. There's a reason why they use the word practice, because for some of us, it doesn't come very naturally. For some of us, it's, you know, a little bit more tricky. So how do we actually exercise the gift of hospitality? How do we do life together? Do we meet together every day? I heard a church leader a few months ago who said he met with his small group at 5:30 every morning. Interesting. I would die if I met with my small group. I love my small group, but I would not function well if I had to meet them at 5:30 every morning. I'm not sure that any of us would, or maybe some. I don't actually think you need to meet people every day to feel connected with them. I think that if you meet people on a consistent basis over a consistent period of time, you do get to know them. It takes a little bit of time, right? You have to get through the sort of awkward bits. But I would say now, probably do know the people in my group pretty well. And that if I really needed to, I could call on them. I hope that if they needed to, they could call on me. I think we start to function as we reach out to each other. Some people notice things about other people and will reach out. And that's how it starts to function. We don't all do it all the time. We do as God leads us. We do as God inspires us. But we have a commitment to meeting together. Now, our church, as we know, has a high turnover of people. It's right in the middle of London. We don't generally live right next door to each other. We can't just pop in. We normally have to make appointments or fix times to see people. So how do we actually create that context? How do we do it? And I'm just really going to slightly reiterate some of the things which we said on the Pastoral Sunday, but just to think about it a little bit more. And actually, I'm only going to reiterate it for a very short time. And then we're going to pray. So I think we do need to choose to let people in, firstly. I heard a story from a church leader of a person who used to come up for ministry, and she used to come up every single week for about a year. And he was, you know, just quite interested why she'd do it. And anything was called forward, you know, particular things would be called forward, and she'd be up there and she would get prayer. And she said to them, actually, you know, the reason I do it is because it's the only time in my week where I can guarantee someone will touch me intentionally and in a kind way. Now, how sad is that? I think that's so sad. Because in the rest of my week, you know, I might get hustled on the tube if I don't walk fast enough on my Oyster card says seek assistance. But that is not a kind touch. No one is intentionally reaching out to me. A good hug is life itself. How sad if we can't guarantee getting a good hug in our week. I don't think that anyone in the church should be in that situation. But they are. So we need to choose, as members of the church, to open up our lives to people. Not to everybody, not all the time, but, you know, just be open to the possibility of inviting people around, of talking to people, of having conversations, of doing life together. A general thing, come to the gathering things, come to wine o'clock. You know, the shed I know was really good. Come to all those kind of things where we meet people. Because when we meet people and we're talking to them, we suddenly get a thing of, I could invite them around. Why don't we go and have a picnic? Why don't we go and do something? And then there's a little connection made, and it's a little bit like a spider's web. There's connection and connection and connection, and the whole thing grows a bit stronger. We need people who get us, don't we? We need people who accept us. We know that God has a settled attitude of grace over us. We know that, right? And we also need to extend that to other people. And the trouble with extending that to other people is we're essentially extending it to people who are quite annoying some of the time. You know, I am a very annoying person. I know it's impossible to believe. I know it is. But, you know, we all have our foibles and quirks and weird things that we come out with. We're weird, right? You know, you really know how weird someone is when you marry them, and suddenly you just think, you spend the first sort of 3 years trying to explain why they're weird and expecting them to change, and then you realise, no, they're just like that, and they're not going to change. You know, we're all strange, but we need to know people well enough to have a settled attitude of grace towards people. So you don't need to have a settled attitude of grace to people you don't really know. You can just smile at them nicely in a vague way and then come and sit down. That doesn't really cost you anything at all. In order to love people, in order for love to cover a multitude of sins, you've got to know people well enough to know kind of where they're sinning, not where they're sinning, but, you know, and how irritating they can actually be. So when God looks at Ed or John or, you know, Stephanie or Anita, he will say, you know, I have a settled attitude of grace towards them. And I want to be the person who says, I have a settled attitude of grace towards you. And I want to know people who know me for who I am, and who love me for who I am. It's fine if people love kind of a fake view of you. It's all right. It's quite nice. But it's not as comforting, is it, as someone who can look you in the face and say, you know what? I see all of that. I see it all. But I still accept you. And that is when we actually begin to belong. And that is when we can actually be free enough to be transformed. If we feel like we have to hide who we are, then transformation can't happen. If we feel we have people who accept us for who we are, then we might begin to dare to say, you know what? I'm really struggling with this at the moment. And the other person can come alongside us. And we've been talking about formations, and we've been talking about small groups. You know, formations are four people. no, it doesn't fit in, but, you know, who choose to intentionally gather together to do that for each other, to meet together, to be discipled together, to encourage each other and to spur one another on. So I would say that everybody in church needs some kind of smaller context where people know us, because we can't possibly know everyone. I'm not going to tell, you know, all of you about the ridiculous things that I do or don't do. But, you know, but I need to be able to tell some people, because they need to be able to encourage me. They need to be able to love me, to cover a multitude of sins, to express all the things that we read in those passages. So I would say do something. It doesn't really matter what, but, you know, formations are good in London because they don't need big rooms. You don't need to meet every week. And if you're interested at all, there's flyers at the back. Again, we need people who are a little bit further ahead of us in the journey sometimes, don't we? You know, it's great fun talking to young people now, because I can be almost prophetic in what they're struggling with. You know, or people who are newly married. So we had a couple around for supper a couple of weeks ago, and it was like, it's amazing. It's amazing what you're saying. You know, that's just it. That's just what happens. You know, are we very prophetic? Well, in that instance, no. We've just seen a lot of life. And we've just done life. We're a little bit ahead. So we kind of know a little bit more of what we're talking about. Or with children. You know, the people I am currently most interested in talking to are people who've had teenagers and survived teenagers and still like their teenagers. You know, and those are the people I'm drawn to. Because I want to believe that it's, you know, I love you, darling. I do, really. Not you, just the others. Yeah. You know, you want to believe it's possible, so I hold on to those people. I hold on to the fact that Sue Digay, whose children are older now, called the teenage years the Tippex years, because you just wanted to wipe them out. I like that. And they're nice kids. I know all her kids. They're really nice kids. So I hold on to these things. So I would definitely encourage you to mentor. If you haven't already signed up to mentor, you definitely know more than people who are a little bit younger or a little bit kind of not as far on the journey of life as you. So mentor them. You know, it's great. I mentor about 4 or 5 people. I see them apparently for too long, but I see them once a month. And I love speaking. I love meeting them. I love all of them. And, you know, I don't think I'm hugely wise, but I have some things I might say, you know what, I could speak this into them. And it's a great privilege to see. And so the great thing is when their victories become your victories, and it really feels like, yes, I kind of helped with that. That's really good. And when, you know, and when we can stand alongside people. And we know we need help in extra tricky times, when mentoring isn't maybe enough or formations aren't enough, but we need to actually go and have some external help and advice. And that's part of the reason we set up the listening service, so that people can go and have to chat with more experienced counsellors who can just offer a little bit more than maybe a prayer on a Sunday. So we need all these connections, don't we? We need to be, I'm going to read that passage again, be devoted to one another. Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Honor one another above yourselves. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. So I would encourage all of us, whether we find it really, really easy or whether we find it slightly challenging, to exercise the gift of hospitality. Reach out to each other in this community. Just make the first move. Don't wait for people to ask you. Be brave and invite them. Let's do life together, because when we do that, that's when we feel we are deeply loved, not just by God, who we know loves us, but by the people around us. And that's really how this body functions as the body of Christ. Amen.